Good morning. Y'all ready to go? 57 years of marriage. Let's hear it for them again, right there on the fourth row. They sat down at 56 years last night, he told me, but then remembered that it was actually 57. So that's okay, whatever. If you're in the ballpark, we're good to go with that. Well, this morning we're going to talk about avoiding marital drift. They want me to give you this, so you can go ahead and click on that so you don't have to take notes if you don't want to. You can just grab the slides. Talking about marital drift today, your marriage is only going to do one of two things. You're either choosing to enjoy life together, making that decision, moving in that direction, or you're not. No one ever wakes up in the morning and decides to drift. Drift is not a decision. It's not something we choose. It's something we just stop doing. We stop pursuing. And so as we talk about this, I always love to start with this picture of my family. I talked about my daughter getting married in May, and this is Corinne and the pervert, Caden. And I like to call this picture, first comes love, then come in-laws. And this was actually at their engagement, which was the day after the re-engage conference last year. We went home to this on the afternoon, and we're both families from the Midwest. And I have to laugh when families from the Midwest go to the beach. We do not know how to behave at the beach. I'm from Illinois. My wife is from Nebraska. And she was born in Minnesota, moved to Nebraska. And you can always see a Midwest family on the beach because they're in matchy-matchy outfits taking pictures. But again, we don't know how to behave. So I went online and found out what's really going on with some of these pictures. That's a family from Indiana right there, not knowing how to behave. This next picture is even better. That's a family from Iowa, and I love it. Mom's face is saying, "We are terrible parents," and Dad's face is saying, "We're having a good time. We're having a good time." I love to use this picture to start off this session because I use it to talk about the importance of launching our children from the home. Our children are not supposed to be with us forever, and mom and dad have to step away from the side of their children, according to Genesis 2:24, and allow the two to become one. And so we leave home physically, emotionally, relationally. The relationship changes, and we pursue life together through the toilsome labor together. And so really this session, if I were doing a marriage conference, is a follow-up to the one I did last night or when I just speak all on laughter and marriage, just enjoying life together. Well, what happens when you're no longer enjoying life? What happens when you don't have what you once had or you're not experiencing what you first experienced in marriage? And so this session is about five symptoms of drift, what you can do to avoid them, but then what can you do if you're in them already? And how can you get out and stay out? And so we're going to spend the most time with the first symptom because almost every couple I work with deals with this very first symptom, and it's simply this. Deciding versus drifting. This is an important chart, and I would just encourage you, if you didn't download the notes, take a picture of it. Because most marriages, couples, relationships start off the same in the attraction chemistry. They have the same level of relationship satisfaction. But it's what you do at the point of connection and which direction you take. Last night we talked about the seasons and stages of life. And make no mistake, the seasons and stages of life change us. I think it's one of the things our country wasn't prepared for, our world wasn't prepared for. And a lot of churches were not prepared for how much the pandemic would change us. We're fools to think that it didn't. It changed us. It was grief. It was loss. And so what do you do in your marriage when your spouse changes? One of my friends in marriage ministry says, over the course of your marriage, you will be married to 5 to 7 different people. That's how often the seasons and stages of life change us. Marriage itself changes you. Kids will change you. Bills change you, a mortgage change you, job changes you. When we get to Ecclesiastes 12, we learn that the body begins breaking down and your body finds its way into the grind of life. And physical changes change personality as well. So it's important to understand because if I'm on the path of decision and the seasons and stages of life start changing me, start changing Amy. Well, now we live in discovery. And discovery is curiosity and fascination. I love the Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 14. My dove in the clefts of the rock and the hiding places of the mountainside. Right? He invites her out. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your face is sweet and your voice is lovely. I want to get to know you. I want to get to know you when the seasons and stages of life change us. That's discovery leading to devotion and dedication. But if you're no longer deciding to enjoy life together, and the seasons and stages of life begin to change you, and you're in drift, well, now you're in disillusionment. This isn't what I signed up for. He's changed. She's changed. I always love in a counseling session that both sides of that coin can be shared with me. They can spend 30 minutes explaining to me how their spouse changed. And then when you start talking about the changes that they can bring into their marriage, they turn to, well, he's never going to change. She's never going to change. No, we've already established that. Change is possible. Change is inevitable. It's going to happen. But if you're going through the changes and the seasons and the stages, living in drift, you're going to go to disillusionment, not catching it, disconnection, ultimately to divorce. And so this first symptom is the one we'll spend the most time with. And it's simply this: when your marriage drifts, you blame your spouse. You blame your spouse. And I, years ago, asked the Lord for an illustration on this, because in my home with two small children, let's say they were 7 and 9, I was exhausted walking into the family room and be like, what is going on? And the blame game would start. Well, she started it. Well, he licked me first. I'd be like, all right, everybody into the kitchen. And I kept under our kitchen sink this $5 restaurant pitcher, and I simply call it the love jug. And anytime the blame game came into our home, whether it be with our kids or Amy and I was always reminded of the love jug. And I would pull this out, and I would go, kids, into the kitchen. We're going to do a quick little lecture. And whenever this came out, the dread that came across my children's faces. Carson even once goes at 7, Dad, would you please give us a spanking instead? This is brutal. I said, no, love jug is out. Lecture begins. And I'm going to give this to you. I would give it to my son when he was 7. Carson, what is this? It's the love jug. I go, Carson, what does it represent? It represents my heart. Carson, how much are you responsible for your heart? I am 100% responsible for my heart. How much is your sister responsible for your heart? She is 0% responsible for my heart. And then as a family, and I think every family needs this verse memorized, Proverbs 4:23, which says, above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. I love all the word pictures in Proverbs for the heart. In Proverbs 3:3, we get this tablet. The heart is a tablet. Messages can be written upon the heart. That's what we call in counseling your family of origin, right? Your mom and dad, because you were watching, listening, remembering, and repeating, they shared with you thousands and thousands and thousands of messages written upon your heart. And then you married someone from another family of origin with thousands and thousands and thousands of messages on their heart. And that's where this clash comes in. The wellspring is in Proverbs 4:23. This means every word I speak and every action I take flows from the heart. And our kids have had this verse memorized since they were young, because I want them to know that their heart matters to me most. I am one parent who does not want to obsess over the behavior of my children. I want to obsess over the hearts of my children. Because the heart is where all the behavior comes from. The heart is where all the words come from. Same thing in my marriage. And so I'd go over to the sink, and I'd grab the hose, and I'd start filling it up. I go, Carson, what does this represent? He goes, it represents God's love. This is where he starts softening a little bit. And I go, yeah. And I said, Carson, how full do we want to be of God's love? Right? Because 1 John says we're to know and rely on the love God has for us. He is the source. We want to be as full as possible. I go, Carson, this is why, according to Deuteronomy 6, we from the time we get up in the morning to the time we go to sleep at night, as we sit at home, as we walk along the way, we're talking about the Lord. We pray together as a family at mealtime, outside of mealtime. We do devotions together. We memorize scripture together all throughout the day, because we want to be as full as possible. And this is where the illustration gets fun. I go over to the cupboard and I start grabbing all different shapes and sizes of glasses, and these represent the people that I will be pouring into throughout the day. So let's just say this is Ted Cunningham's heart right here, and these are all the people that I'm going to meet throughout the day. And who's the first person I want to pour into? My wife. And I grew up, I told you last night, an independent, fundamental, premillennial, King James Version only. This is not an approved glass, okay? This, I let, McGee let me borrow one from his house. So I want to pour into Amy. And Amy and I have made the decision as a couple, we want to give each other what we call choice overflow. Too many couples pour into everyone and everything else, and whatever little bit they have left, they give to each other. One of the commitments we've made in our marriage is let's give each other the best of our words, the best of our time, the best of our energy. Let's not save little bit left that usually can sometimes be toxic because we're so worn out from the day and come home at night and give that to each other. Let's make a commitment to give the best. And after we got married, we were deciding, man, something's still missing. What do we need? Our marriage needs something. What can we do? What can we have that'll bring joy to our life and fill us up like 24 hours a day, 7 days? We need children, right? If we have children, that'll fill us up. And so we started having kids and realized nothing sucks the life out of you faster than a child. But we had Corinne, and she was an easy firstborn child. Raise your hand if you had an easy firstborn child. Let me just see. All right, now watch this. How many of you took credit for that easy firstborn child? And how does God fix that cocky attitude in you, right? He gives you child number two, and child number two comes out. And we read all the parenting books, and we said, man, we are so good at this parenting thing. We should bless the earth with more of our children. And then we had Carson and decided the earth had plenty of children. We didn't need to have any more children. But that's just my wife and kids, and I poured out half. My mom and dad retired from Lucent Technologies in Chicago 20 years ago. They moved down to Branson, and they live two streets over. And my dad, for the last 20 years, has watched Fox News 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I'll walk in the house, I'll be like, hey, Dad, how's it going? To which he responds, well, we're going to hell in a handbasket. That's how it's going. The world's falling apart. There ain't gonna be nothing left for you kids, that's for sure. Well, hey, Dad, I have told you, you got to start watching more Joel Osteen. You can't be angry all the time. You need some happy. I need to get some happy in your life. Hold up your Bible. And anyway, so my mom is super easy to pour into. My mom just wants me connected to the family. That's it. She wants me talking to my brother, who's 4 years older than me. She wants me coming to the family gatherings and engaging. My mom doesn't want any more stuff. She just wants me engaged. This little shot glass here represents my mother-in-law. You don't want to give her too much. And then I haven't even been to work. And everybody in here has one person at work that you know sucks the life out of you. You try to avoid them. They're the first phone call that you're like, you see it on your phone, you're like, ugh. My kids would never get, with this first symptom, my kids would never get the textbook definition of codependency, which is excessive emotional reliance. They didn't get that at 7 and 9 years old. They didn't even get my mentor, Dr. Gary Smalley's definition of codependency, which is plugging into people, places, or things as your source of life. But this definition they got, and they have it to this day as young adults. Codependency is pouring into all of these people, sitting around on empty, waiting for them to pour back into you. And it's a miserable way to live your life. It's an exhausting and draining way to live your life. The most miserable marriage on the planet is this right here. A couple plugged into each other as the source of life. I just said the thing I know you like me to say. When am I gonna get a little something, something coming back? Miserable way to live. You want to know the best way to live? Fire each other as a source of life. Plug into the true and only source of life. For God is love, and we love because he first loved us, and we know and rely on that love. So we stay connected to the true and only source of life and spend our days giving each other choice overflow. That's the key. That's the secret to a life-giving marriage. Firing each other as a source. So let's do that real quick. I always love to start this. Raise your right hand and repeat after me. You'll never forget this. I state your name. You're better than this, Texas. You're better than this. Do hereby resign as general manager of the universe and my spouse. Now, this will set you free. Point to your spouse for the very last time and say, you're fired. You will no longer suck the life out of me. No, we're done. We're done talking. That was just me adding. Here, you know the problem with all these people? Limited supply. There's enough people in here with business smarts to tell you limited supply makes people desperate. Makes people desperate. It's why we all lost our minds with toilet paper 2 years ago, because it was limited supply. We'd go in and see a few left on the shelf. Right, that's what it does. It makes us clingy. Seldom set foot in your neighbor's house. Too much of you and they will hate you. Right? We don't want to be that clingy person, but when you find a clingy person, it's that excessive emotional reliance. They're wanting something from you that you're not supposed to give them. All of these people, limited supplies, and to remind you, he has unlimited free refills. Stay connected to the source, and you got all you ever need to pour into them. You remember the morning we woke up to the dreaded news Twinkies went bankrupt? Does anybody remember that? You hadn't had a Twinkie in 20 years, but your first thought was, limited supply. We do the same thing with our kids, right? We plug into our children as the source of life, connecting them to us, and we have fallen for this faulty input-output theory of parenting that says, whatever I pour into my child is what I will get out of my child. And the Hebrew term for that is, ha! It's not true. It's not true. My job isn't to connect my children to me as the source. My job is to point my children to the true and only source and keep pointing them to that source each and every day. You know what happened when you just fired your spouse as the source of life? You just freed yourself up to pour into your spouse. This is what ends the blame game. You just freed yourself up to pour into your spouse with zero expectations of anything coming back to you. And that is a freeing, life-giving marriage. Zero expectations of anything coming back to you. I have a face that screams retail. I can't fully explain it. Anybody else get, I get asked in stores all the time, stores and restaurants, excuse me, do you work here? Does anybody else have this problem? I get so tired of being asked this question, I don't fight it anymore. I just say, how may I help you? And I just go with whatever they need. And we were a few years back at our favorite restaurant in Branson. It's called Sugar Leaf. And it's just a sandwich shop, and we were at a high-top table like this in the restaurant, and I got up to use the restroom. I'm going to the restroom. I look over in the corner, and I see this couple, mid-70s, completely and totally ticked off. And I went, okay, well, I got a second. So I walk over to their table, and I simply ask him, hey, how was everything? And he goes, I got to be honest with you, we're pretty frustrated. I said, ugh. I said, I hate to hear that. I said, what seems to be the problem? He said, your sign outside said bratwurst, and we stood in line for 20 minutes waiting for bratwurst, and we get to the front, and you're out of bratwurst. And I know I'm not that old, I'm getting there, but I can't wait until the day in my life when the biggest issue of my day, I mean the thing that really ticks me off, like the sucks life out of me, is a store being out of bratwurst. You're the only one not laughing, sir, 57 years. Seniors don't laugh at that. They're like, he should take this more seriously if you're going to offer that. I said, sir, what can we do to make this right? And it starts changing his tune. I said, sir, what if I get you a piece of pie? And you can ask, right? Pie changes lives, doesn't it? You can't be mad while eating pie. He becomes a new person. So I go, I stand in line, I buy him a piece of pie, I bring it back, I set it down in front of him, and he starts asking me questions about the restaurant. And I'm like, hey, whoa, I don't work here. That's my family over there. My whole family deadpan from across the restaurant goes like this to the couple because they know what's going on. I go to the bathroom. I come back, hit the table. I'm fired up. I like drugs coursing through my veins. I said, what is this, guys? Why am I so excited about this? This is exactly what Jesus said to us when he said the Son of Man did not come to be served but to serve. And when you can give, love, pour, serve, expecting nothing in return, it's become like a hobby for me. Like, how can I, not just with my family, I do this with strangers. You want to take this up a notch. The next restaurant you go to, stop by on your way to the host or hostess taking you to the table, grab a water pitcher off the bus station, and on your way there, just start filling up empty water glasses. I've never once in all the years I've done this been asked to stop. The wait staff looks at you funny, but after about 2 minutes, they're like smoke break, and they're out the back door. They let me do it. They've seen me doing it. I've had waitresses and waiters come by and throw a towel at me and go, could you get that table next to you when you're done with that? It's a ball. You want to take it up a notch, wear a red polo to Target. And just start answering questions. This is the freedom. This is what ends the blame game. When you fire your spouse as the source, because you don't know this, but the ultimate level of stuckness in marriage is you looking at your spouse as the source of all your problems. when your spouse is the source of all your problems, you've automatically set your spouse up to be the solution. When your spouse is the source and the solution, you're stuck. There's nothing you can do. The better way and the way out of this symptom of drift, the way to stay out of this symptom is simply fire your spouse, pour with zero expectation. If you don't catch it right here, it leads to this next symptom, which is when your marriage drifts, you close your heart. That wellspring of life, you just shut it down, nothing going in, nothing coming out. You become full of resentment, bitterness, rage, malice. You've encountered a lot of hearts like this. Some of you, I have a guilt-prone nature. Who has a guilt-prone nature? Let me just see. You meet toxic people and you think it's your fault. So you bump into somebody and something comes out of them and you're like, I do this. I'm like, what did I just say? What did I just do? What just came out of them was already in them. I just bumped into them and it's coming out. That's why I love Ted's talk this morning. It was like to have that moment when you bump into your spouse and something comes out, instead of going, well, what did I do? What did I say? What? We immediately make everything about us instead of, whoa, 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 what just came out of you? Let's talk about that. Let's find out what's going on so I can not fix it for you or help you through it. But I want to know. I want understanding. I met a lady on the East Coast years ago. I do a session called From Anger to Intimacy, and it was after that session that she met me at the book table. She was shaking. She was so mad. She walked up to the book table, and she said, Pastor! I was like, what? She said, my husband left me. Do you know why he left me? I'm getting a little picture of it, but I'm sure it's not the whole thing. And then she said this, and I've heard pretty much, I feel like I've heard every reason for divorce. Money, sex, jobs, kids, parents, parenting styles, I mean, all that. I've never heard this. She said, my husband left me because he couldn't handle being married to a successful woman. Like, okay, all right, here we go. I said, ma'am, success did not cause your divorce. And she goes, what do you think of this? I said, I go, I noticed it from across the room. She goes, what's that? I go, the ginormous chip on your shoulder. It's huge. I don't know who put it there. I don't know what was said. I don't know how long it's been there. But I've got good news for you. I go, can I pastor you for 5 minutes? I took her silence as consent. I go, the good news for you is you're 100% responsible for it. Now, I always have to be careful there because some people just heard me say you are 100% to blame for it. I didn't say she's 100% to blame for it. I said, you get to choose now. And this is tough in the culture that we live in right now. It feels like everyone I work with either, you know, is a victim or has a mental health issue. It's a challenge to try. And I find myself referring people on all of the time because they're like, if I can put something on this, then I don't have to deal with it. And I'm like, no, I'm not saying we can work through whatever trauma maybe came into your life, but you have to choose for you what you're going to do with this. Why? Because I told her two things that Gary Smalley taught me years ago when we were writing the book, From Anger to Intimacy. He caught me, I left Dallas Seminary in 2001 and went to a church in Forsyth, Missouri that was running about 500 people. They're 5 years old. The founding pastor had just practiced church discipline on a businessman in his church, and it cost the guy his business. He sued the church. This pastor won a financial judgment against him. Founding pastor leaves, and at 26 years old, this is cocky what I'm about to tell you. I thought, I'll fix it. I'll help him work through this. At 26, I know nothing. And I get up there and walk into the biggest mess I've ever walked into in my life, and it started to affect my heart. And that's when I met Gary Smalley. And he took me out to Bob Evans, and he told me these two things about anger that I shared with this lady that day. Unresolved anger is like drinking poison, expecting the other person to get sick. And he said, Ted, some people sip this poison every day. Others drink it by the gallons. And I'm sitting across the table right now from now a 27-year-old pastor who is drinking it by the gallons. You got to do something with it. Because the second thing, which is what I had to tell this lady as well, you never bury anger dead. You always bury it alive. It will resurface in another relationship. That's why when I work with someone, whether they're dealing with trauma or they're dealing with a mental health, it's like, we've got to do something to help you get healthy for you to take personal responsibility on this journey. Because if you don't remarry, I go, you've got, and this lady was standing next to her 12-year-old son. I said, the problem is the anger you have toward your ex-husband will one day resurface on your son. That's how anger works. I view anger like a pet. It's the best word picture I've been able to give to my kids since they were small. Some people get angry, and anger, you know, is a secondary emotion. It's not a primary emotion. You always feel something before you get angry. You feel judged. You feel controlled. You feel like a failure. You feel disconnected. You feel rejected. You feel abandoned. We isolate about 27 common core fears that people can deal with. But if you don't deal with it at the primary emotion level, it turns to anger. And this is what people have a harder time letting go of. But some people get angry, and it's like a carnival goldfish. They've got it a couple of days, and it's gone. Others are like when we went to get my daughter's guinea pig when she was like 10 years old, and she's so excited to get this guinea pig, and she's standing there at the cage looking for which one she's going to get. I pull the sales associate at Petco aside. I go, ma'am, can I talk to you for a second? She comes over. I said, ma'am, how long is this thing going to live? And with enthusiasm, she said, between 5 and 7 years. And I was like, ugh. I said, what do we got in the 2 to 3 year range is really what that's about the level of commitment I'm able to. This smug 17-year-old sales associate looks at me and says, sir, maybe you're not ready for the responsibility of a pet. I said, I don't want the thing. I said, and by the way, this isn't my issue. This is your issue, Petco. I come in here, you have this whole store laid out by species. It needs to be laid out by lifespan, right? You come over here. Here's a couple of months, maybe a couple of years. You get to 15 years. Some of you, you're carrying around a guinea pig with your closed heart and your unresolved anger. And every day with your thoughts, bitterness, you're just feeding little pellets to this guinea pig. But some of you ain't got a guinea pig. Some of you have got a parrot. And I don't know, this was handed to you from your parents, because I don't know if you know this. Parrots outlive their owners. They get left to the children in the will. Can you imagine going to that lawyer's office? Okay, you get the house, you get the accounts, and you get the bird. You're like, that's what it feels like I'm getting right now. And you carry this bird around everywhere for a lifetime. You know what needs to happen to the bird? And this illustration works in Texas. The bird needs to come down off your shoulder, thrown into the air, and yell, pull! That's what needs to happen to the bird. When I give this illustration in California, I always release the bird in a forest preserve down the road. I would never... They don't like killing animals in California, so... I meet it all the time. I can't tell you. I obviously don't walk around with a love jug. I don't keep one at the office. I don't, you know, like, sit. But I picture it in people as I'm talking to them. I wonder how full they are, and I wonder what little bit they may have left and how toxic it is. Can I just tell you, most of the time when I'm meeting with couples, it's two of these pictures completely and totally empty. And that's why everything is everywhere on each other. And I'm like, these people are empty, and stuff's happened in their marriage. The forgiveness, which is the way out of this symptom, they think they have a spouse problem. They don't have a spouse problem. They have a source problem, just like serving and giving, right? Because he gives me everything I need. Forgive as God has forgiven you in Christ Jesus. That's why we have the parable of the unmerciful servant. This guy's been forgiven a multi-million dollar debt. That's poured into him. It's overflowing, the forgiveness he's received. He goes and finds someone who owes him a couple of bucks, beaten and thrown in jail. We do that all the time when we don't forgive people. Remember, he is your source. No matter what has happened to you, connect with him, the true and only source. But if you don't grab it here, at this, you move to the third symptom. And this is where I encourage and challenge with biblical community. You begin to isolate from others. This is when we're sitting around church leaders, and they're like, you know, I haven't seen so-and-so in a while. Where are they at? And a lot of times when you let that blame game move to a closed heart and you just shut down, you don't want to be around people with an eternal perspective, grounded theologically. You don't want to be around that person who maybe has experienced what you've experienced or what you're experiencing. And you don't want to be told... Yeah, we went through that, and here's kind of what we did, because you've fallen for the lie that says no one gets what you're going through. This has only happened to you. You're the only one that has experienced this. This is why we say at our church, I shared it last night, every marriage is a duet in need of great backup singers. Some of you may be new to Watermark, but it's what I love about this church, and I've been friends with John McGee and Scott Kudersia for a long time. Great backup singers. I get the opportunity to be in 2-3 churches a weekend around the country and find myself, it seems like every other event is a re-engaged church. And what I love about going to those churches is they get this right here, the need for biblical community, the leaning into biblical community when a couple is hurting, when a couple is in crisis, or when a couple says, I'm at a 6 or a 7, but I'd like to go to an 8 or 9. This works in Branson. We desire to be backup singers to the duets all around us. I don't know. We have something in Branson called a marriage intensive. Gary Smalley with his son Greg Smalley years ago decided we're going to be the 911 or the Mayo Clinic for marriages in crisis. And so Gary started the flagship marriage intensive program. We do them in Rome, Georgia now in a partnership with Chick-fil-A, Michigan. We closed on property in Cave Creek, Arizona. And so these are going, thousands of couples have been through the marriage intensive program over the last 25 years. And to share with you what it is, you have either filed the paperwork, separated, or you've divorced. And a lot of times people come to a marriage intensive so they can tell their family and friends, we've tried everything. And we ask one question. You only have to answer one question to come to a marriage intensive, and it's, are you open to a miracle? Are you open to a miracle? You'd be shocked at the number of people who say no. I'm not open to it. I don't want it. But if you'll answer that question with a yes, and you're not medicating with drugs or alcohol, because that has to get taken care of first, we invite you to Branson. And the flagship intensive program is 5 couples on a U-shaped couch for 4 days, 8 hours a day with 2 therapists. And I always love giving that because I see guys going, oh, no, I love you. I love you. I am committed to this marriage. But I will do a colonoscopy before I do whatever that guy's telling me to do. But I got to tell you, I mean, so think about it. They show up on Sunday. They have breakfast on Monday morning, and they go into this intensive room. They don't know the other 4 couples. And I love day one. Day one is tell me your marriage story. How did you get to this place? Because nobody starts at this place, right? We just said in that chart, we start traction and chemistry. We're starting at pretty much the same level of relationship satisfaction as one another. How did we get to this place? You know the power of that first day, which I love? The power of that first day is you get to hear 4 other couples, and you get to hear their story. We want you to hear their story, go back to your room that night, and look to your spouse, who you've been in crisis with for a while, and be like, wow. At least we're not as jacked up as those other couples. We also say this at our church. Everybody falls in love with the front end of the puppy. But every puppy has a back end. That's the power of the duet. Every single marriage has a back end story. That's what I love about the videos they're playing, interviewing couples in between the sessions and in between the speakers. You're reminded, you know, others, it may look a little different. Your season or stage may look a little different, but just trust me, when you see a couple married 57 years enjoying life together, it's not an accident. They didn't stumble into this. They're choosing this. They're deciding on this. They're staying on that path of decision. Why I use a bus is because I'm here to tell you, if you're in that place where your heart's closed and you're isolated from others, or you ever get to that place, all it takes is a decision to turn the bus around. You can choose to do that. I love Ecclesiastes 9:7-9. Eat your food with gladness. Drink your wine with a joyful heart. For now God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white. Always anoint your head with oil. And then it says, enjoy life with your wife. Before you get to all of that, in verse 4, what do we read? Anyone who is among the living has hope. If you're breathing, you can choose to turn the bus around. You can repent. You can confess. You can find a new marriage. Where do we get this symptom from? We get it from the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 4. Here are the daughters of Jerusalem singing back up over the duet of Solomon and the Shulamite woman. And I love it. It's the first time we hear from them in the book, and I just love these 3 words: rejoice, delight, and praise. That's a great backup singer. Someone who's rejoicing, delighting, and praising your love. And frankly, I see this with too many couples. So what's our way to protect ourselves from this type of drift or to find our way out of this level of drift? You need to surround yourself with healthy voices. One of the things I love to do with couples when I'm meeting with them is give them each a yellow pad when I can tell, if it, and I'll stop in the middle of a session, whatever we're talking about, and hand them the yellow pad because I want to know, I feel like there's other voices in the room. I can't see them. I don't know who they are, so I just have to ask. I go, hey, would you write down on a, individually, write down all the voices of influence into your marriage, all the people who've influenced your marriage over the years. And then I like to take those two lists and combine them, and we go through one at a time. Who do we need to turn down? Who do we need to mute altogether? And then who do we need to turn way up? I find with most couples, there's going to be one or two that they can land on. And I'm not asking you to have a choir. You need a backup singer. And so you're like, well, what happens if one of the mutes is a parent? I'm not telling you don't go home for the holidays. I'm not telling you to not gather with your family. I'm just saying you're making the decision as a couple. They are not rejoicing and delighting in us. They're not praising our love. This is not someone we're going to allow to be an influence. I see it too many times, that couple in crisis, and I just have to tell the husband or the wife, you know, you got to stop having lunch with that jaded coworker. It's not helping. It's not helping. It's not a good voice. We rejoice and delight in you. We praise your love more than wine, because a bad backup singer is going to help you go to symptom four. They're going to bring doubt. A bad backup singer says things like, you've tried everything. Oh, come on, man, he ain't ever going to change. She ain't ever going to change. Or he's changed, she's changed. Honey, I just want you to be happy. If you're a mother-in-law, a father-in-law in here, I want to encourage you, because I'm now a backup singer to my daughter and son-in-law's duet, and I want to be a great backup singer. And here's, I know, the first step in getting there. I want to be an advocate for their marriage, not just my child. I want to be an advocate for both of them. I want to praise their love. I want to delight in them. I want to rejoice in them. I want to celebrate what God is doing in their life and call it out, because bad backup singers help you doubt. They help you doubt. I grew up, I told you last night, in an independent, fundamental, premillennial, King James Version, only Baptist church, and we had this thing in the spring and fall called a revival. Does anybody know what I'm talking about when I say revival? Okay. If you don't know what a revival is, we brought in this hellfire and brimstone preaching evangelist in the spring and the fall, and we had some angry little evangelists. I got to tell you, they were mean little fellas who preached about hell with such excitement. And I remember at 10 years old going, I don't think we're supposed to be this excited about people going there. But these guys just had an enthusiasm for it. And I was at Valley Baptist Church, Oswego, Illinois, sitting next to my parents at these revivals. Every twice a year growing up. And it was started on Sunday and then every night of the week through Friday. And there's 80 to 100 of us in there. 80 to 100 of us in this church, and this guy would preach. He'd step down and give an invitation. No one would come forward, and I was always like, oh, boy, here we go. No one's getting saved. Okay, second verse, no one comes forward. He then would turn on the Christians, and I'll never forget this guy sitting down front, and there'd be a room smaller than this, like less people than this, and he would go, do you know that you know that you know that you know? And I'm going, well, I thought I knew. You put it like that, probably not. But I remember sitting, I'd look around the room while he's giving this invitation. I'm like, I know every person in here. We've all been saved multiple times. We've all been baptized multiple times. And at 10, I said this to my dad, hey, if I go up there, can we go home? I'll take one for the team. Let's get this going. If getting saved gets me home and in front of the TV again, let's do it. And my dad's hand would come around my mom and smack me on the back, all right, and stand there. But I can remember at 10 this firing me up, going, how dare, is this what you're supposed to be doing here? I said, bro, I'm in. I'm here every Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. I'm marching in the Lord's army. I'm flying over the enemies. I'm here. You can't be any more in. You can't decide any more than I've decided. I'm in it to win it. You're not supposed to be here bringing doubt to believers. We want to see the lost get saved. We should be out there reaching them and not in here all week. I'm still working through things when I go through this. This is a lot of, I still fight against fundamentalism with every ounce of my being. Anyway, but that to me is what bad backup singers do. See, a good backup singer reminds you of the day you stood before the Lord and said, before God and gathered witnesses, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, for sickness and in health, till death do us part. We replaced until death do us part at our church with until the Lord returns or calls one of us home. And a good backup singer reminds you of that, walks through that with you, helps you understand that, and sees that, and is constantly calling that out. And some of you, maybe that's a decision that, and maybe it's on date night this week, or some of you taking the date night tonight, is to just ask, hey, is there anyone speaking into our marriage right now that we need to turn down? It may not be people you even know. It may just be podcasts you're listening to, books that you read. You're like, you know, when I'm done listening to that person, I don't feel our marriage is stronger. Or when I'm done reading that person, I don't feel our marriage is stronger. And this isn't for me to have the conversation for you. It's for you to have it with one another. There's that family member who, you know, we have family members that we have to limit our time around just because they're frankly toxic. They're toxic, and it's not that I don't love them, care for them, share the gospel with them, but it's just not good for our marriage. And I don't know if this is, are we taping this? Is this being recorded? I can't tell you that story then if I don't know the answer to that question. We have a word. We have an escape word. Do you have an escape word for family gatherings? We always come up with one before we go in. The last time we were with family, it was watermelon. Watermelon meant it's time to go. We'll text it to each other. I'll look at my phone, will buzz, and I'll see watermelon, !! But again, it's not cutting people off. It's just saying we need to spend more time. This is why I'm a big believer in small groups, home groups, community groups, whatever a church calls them, to be surrounded by others who've experienced the seasons and stages of life. And that's why I love to use that illustration last night of the young couple, spending time with a couple married 57 years, because I've made the commitment in my life and in my marriage, I never want to be the oldest person in the small group. I know it's going to become more challenging the older I get, but I always want someone in that group who's experienced a season or stage of life that I haven't. Like when we started having our kids, I remember, this was such a blessing for us. At the six-week visit for Corinne, she was losing a lot of weight, and nursing was not working for us. I remember we had an old crusty doctor, and he's looking at her charts. Head looks great, length looks great. And when he got to her weight chart, the doctor says this with his back turned to us, Amy and I sitting in chairs. Good night. What are you two doing? Trying to starve this baby? Look at the moms in there. I hate him. My wife starts crying. I'm mad. But we had small group that night. I'm just telling you, we could all give hundreds of stories like this. We go sit in small group that night, and I'm mad. Amy's feeling like a terrible mom. And by the way, with this story, I don't need any lactation specialist coming up to me afterwards. I can help with that. Okay, she's an adult now. She survived. But we had read the books, and we weren't going to do formula. And the doctor said, you got to do formula. I go, we're not doing formula. And I remember an older lady in our group got up while Amy and I were having this meltdown over being terrible parents with our first child at 6 weeks old, and she goes into the kitchen without even and I walk in behind her, and she's making a bottle out of formula. And I go, what do you think you're doing? She goes, I'm going to give Corinne this formula. I go, oh, no, you're not. She goes, give me one good reason, Ted, why I can't give Corinne this formula. I go, well, one, I don't want her going to community college. Let's start there, all right? We've read all the books. Formula is going to make her average at best. And I can't believe it. This takes guts, and only your generation has this kind of guts. She went in there, grabbed Corinne from Amy, and we all watched Corinne go, suck that whole bottle down. It was her first time to sleep through the night, and she's now married. And, you know, she's not great at math, but we're trying to focus on her positive qualities, all right? She's got character, competency, not so much. So that's a good backup singer. I think I'm always sad when I meet couples who don't have that. And again, right now you're sitting there going, okay, so what do I got to do? Sign my life away to this church? What do I got to do? Be in groups for the rest of my life? I'm not saying you've got to, you know, commit to 40 people. Amy and I have two couples. That's it. Those are the ones we pour our lives into. They pour their lives into us. And it's all we need for our marriage. We know, we obviously pour into other people, but those are the ones we travel around the world with. Those are the ones we vacation with. Those are the ones we have dinners with. They're rejoicing, delighting, and praising our love. We're rejoicing and delighting in them and praising theirs. I'm supposed to give you Q&A time, so let me get through this last symptom. When your marriage drifts, if you haven't dealt with the four symptoms leading up to this, you will begin to explore other options. This is the people I meet that get on Facebook just to see how that old friend, that old boyfriend, that old girlfriend's doing. And I want to give you my favorite definition of commitment. It comes from Dr. Scott Stanley at the University of Denver. And we all love and respect Dr. Stanley. And he just simply says this about commitment. It's making the choice to give up all other choices. And I'm not going to have you stand up. I've been to a lot of events where they make everybody stand up, turn, face your spouse. We're going to renew vows, and I can see it all over the husband. I'm going to punch that guy in the face. I'm not renewing vows. But maybe it's an opportunity today for you to give the, for better, for worse, richer, poorer. I'm not going anywhere until the Lord returns or calls one of us home. And you want to talk about, I meet what I call like temporary backup singers all the time, and this is Lloyd and Jean from Iowa City, Iowa. I met them years ago at a marriage conference at their church, and they were celebrating 69 years of marriage. And I called back to the church or emailed back to the church every year all the way up to their 73rd wedding anniversary because this couple so blessed me and ministered to me. I'll never forget finishing the conference. They walked up to me, and Lloyd put his finger in my chest, and he said, "Young man, you don't quit this. You don't stop. You keep blessing marriages. I wish we would have had something like this when we were first married." I'm like, "Yeah, you were in World War II. And that you're here at 69 years of marriage trying to make your marriage stronger and greater and investing in it." And he just spoke this massive blessing over me. And Gene didn't say a word, just hung on his arm. I didn't ask him to pose for this picture. This was their resting face. And at the end, I'll never forget, Gene reached in her purse and she grabbed two identical collapsible canes and she handed one to Lloyd. And both of them at the same time, like Indiana Jones, went And I called my wife, and I said, "We need two canes and two of those rockers from Cracker Barrel because we're in this until the Lord returns or calls one of us home." We have about 13 minutes. They wanted me to give 15 minutes to Q&A, and we're going to have a microphone come around with questions, thoughts on any of the symptoms or any of the, even anything I might have said last night, or anything, any question you might have. We are here to serve you this weekend, you and your marriage. Any questions? Right down here. Here we go. She's gonna hand you a microphone if you don't mind. Sorry. Go ahead.
In the beginning, you said anger is buried alive, not dead. Was the second?
The first one was unresolved anger is like drinking poison, expecting the other person to get sick. And that second one is like when I work with pastors, same thing, not just in their marriage. It's they get mad at a church and they think packing up the boxes, some magical transformation is going to happen in the U-Haul between churches. And they get there. Gary Small used to say, you can bury your anger for 6, 12, 24, at most 36 months. But it will resurface if you leave it packed. It'll come out at some point, and you have to deal with it. Right there, ma'am.
Thanks. What structure do you put around some of the, like, weekly? Is there daily structure? Not just like we do date night once a week, but other things that you've kind of thought through, this is how we make sure we protect ourselves from drift.
That's great. Great. So we practice three times in our marriage. One of them is the date night, but a mentor, as we were starting the church 20 years ago, we were also starting our family. And he said, "Man, I'm really concerned for you as a young couple. You're going to pour all you got into the church. You're going to pour all you got into these kids and have nothing left for each other." And he said, "You need a daily delay, a weekly withdrawal, and an annual abandon." And by the way, all three of these are in the Song of Solomon. You get, that daily delay is that security that she feels when she's with him. She says when she goes to bed, he's like a sachet of myrrh resting between her breasts, a beautiful word picture. It's the same idea that we get from our grandma when she used to put spices in her dresser, right? That's what permeated the clothes and made them smell good. Well, that's what they would do in that day to perfume their bodies. And she said, I go to bed thinking about him, I dream about him, I wake up thinking about him. So that was that word picture with the sachet of myrrh. So a daily delay for us is 15 to 20 minutes of eyeball to eyeball, body to body. Key here is distraction-free, kid-free, tech-free. You have to pick what time works best for you. My wife wakes up every morning at 5:30. I get up at 5:45. And I'm not kidding. What she can do in that 15 minutes is absolutely amazing. I get up, and she's so giddy with excitement, sitting there ready for me, because we have like little business meetings at 6. And she's got her yellow pad, and I mean, and she's like, can you just let me know when you're ready? And I'm like, wow. And she's like, okay, I'd like to start with the minutes from yesterday's meeting, and you don't have to take notes on any of this, because I will be emailing it to you later this morning. Our daily delay is absolutely best between 6 and 7 a.m., and but not every couple can do that. Some couples, it's after dinner. Some, it's right before bed. But if you do that with, you know, the Holcombs, you're going to have children. But here's what we have found in our research with couples. The first 15 to 20 minutes of reconnection time at the end of the day works for very few couples. Very few couples. Because if you're driving home, like you get home, there's something you want to do, there's something, and you're just not really in the mood at that first moment of reconnection to be like, tell me everything about your day, and here's what we have to do with the kids, and that's a lot of tension in that time. But if you can have 15 to 20 minutes to decompress, sometimes 15 to 20 minutes after first arriving home, that works for a lot of couples. You have to pick what time works for you. Then the weekly withdrawal, this is Song of Solomon chapter 2, where he comes to pick her up, come away with me. I'm taking away the daily delays in the home. The weekly withdrawal would be, away from the home but in town. And that's a date night. We try to do that every single week. Try to give it the whole night. It's a little easier with us now that we're almost empty nesters. But we protect that time. And the reason the daily delay is so important is we let the daily delay be like the mini business meeting and save heavier conversations for the daily delay. Budgets, kids make for terrible date night conversations. Try to keep date night fun and exciting. And I'm always trying to find the new way. Novelty is a key to a great date night experience. Years ago, I remember we were driving trying to figure out what we were going to do for a date. And it dawned on us, 20 years of marriage, we had never been roller skating together. How many of you have never been roller skating together? I always love to see this. Look at that. How many of you have never been roller skating in your life? You see that? Because you did this before you met, because it was a younger person's activity. So I'm 43 years old, and I'm like, we should totally go roller skating tonight. And she's like, what? I go, yeah, let's go to Skateland, Branson, Missouri. And if you haven't been to a skating rink in 30 years, not much has changed at the skating rink in 30 years. They've done no renovations, no remodeling at the skating rink. They still have Trans Ams parked out front, blaring Def Leppard and smoke rolling out the deal. And you remember that guy that he always was skating around? And you're out there, you're not an expert, you're trying to make it, and he would jump in front of you even and do this right here. Yeah, he's still there. He's 80 years old, got wristbands and headbands, but very passionate about it. So we try to think of activities we did as kids, but we've never done as a couple. So we try to keep all that, say the weekly withdrawal is fun. Daily delay, we let that be the little business meeting. And then the annual abandon, this is key. This is Song of Solomon chapter 7, where the Shulamite bride now says to the busy shepherd king, come away with me, let us go to the countryside. So this is out of town, let's get away from all of it. And to me, the key with the weekly withdrawal and the annual abandon is plan it ahead of time so you can reap all the great relational benefits of anticipation. So don't just, like, spontaneous dating is fun, but planned dating is better for the relationship and marital satisfaction, because if you can plan it on a Wednesday or Thursday night for the weekend, or have a Wednesday or Thursday night date, but you plan it on Sunday or Monday, well, now you just get to think about it, and it's something you can anticipate. But those are kind of the ways we think about time. And to be honest with you, we so love the annual abandon. Because I get to speak and travel, we do more than one a year. Doesn't have to be super expensive. Can be, but we love getting away. Believe it or not, like, our favorite annual abandon, Amy and I, is New York City. We love the diversity of the city. We love the food of the city until we found out Dallas has an Eataly too. We're like, yeah, all right. So Dallas and Chicago, for us, because we're a small town and we don't have the variety of food and the choices that you all have in shopping, for us to get on a plane and come to Dallas or go to Chicago or New York, it just refreshes us in a way. We also, in a small town, pastoring a large church in a small town, we can think this is it, but then when we get to a big city and get lost, it's kind of fun to eat without praying for somebody. No, I'm just kidding. I'm a pastor. Nice. That's good. What other questions? Yes, sir. I'm not going to make her run all the way down. I'll repeat it. Yeah. No, that's a great point. So for us, that's one of the reasons why. He just asked, how do you, when your work, right, and work and worship are tied together, right? So when your work is your ministry and you're doing your work as unto the Lord and you pour yourself out and you come home and you're done. Everybody gets that. We're exhausted, we're done, we got nothing left for each other. This is why, whether it be an afternoon lunch appointment, I think we've got to break out of, since so much about the world has changed with our rhythms and our pace, and we live in a gig economy now for so many, this idea of I get up, get ready, go to work, come home, crash, and a little bit of time for family or marriage, I think we have to be a little more fluid with that and find the times that work, whether that be for us, it's early morning, because that's a commitment we made. We're going to do choice overflow, and it kind of sets the whole day so that when we come home and have nothing left, we offer plenty of grace for that. The hard part is if one spouse is really ready to go and the other one's really ready to crash, to find the, starting with 15 to 20 minutes, I promise you, then it will grow. Because a lot of times if couples don't put a time on it, they just are like, well, we got to spend 3 hours together, you know, doing something. And, well, you know, it's just not realistic to think we're going to have eyeball-to-eyeball deep conversation for 3 hours. But in the world, we can make 15 to 20 minutes happen. And it just has to be a time that both people see as a win-win. And it may be a phone call during the day. I have found with a lot of the executives that I coach, I don't do a lot of counseling or intensive counseling for pastors or executives, but I find with a lot of the executives I coach, if they will give 15 to 20 minutes in the middle of their day for a phone call, I mean, other than no other purpose other than to connect, just to connect with their spouse, I'm convinced it makes them productive for the rest of the day, and it takes a lot of the burden off that evening time of, tell me about your day. How'd you feel? I want you to recount it all, and you're like, I don't want to discuss one detail of my day right now. I want to forget about the details of my day. So I would start there. I would settle on the 15 to 20 minutes and when the best time is. And kind of like Sabbath, right? Sabbath refreshes us and makes the other 6 days productive, but you know, it's always not convenient for me to take the Sabbath, but I know how important the Sabbath is for the rest and all that. Same thing for our marriage. I just think if you don't put a time on it, you just leave it out there, then you just sit there in guilt, you know. So I that's where I would start with that. One more question. Or you can just beat the people to the rest of those Bucky snacks. All right, thank you all. What a great time it's been. Thanks for having me.